a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today, folks, we are flashing back to September the 16th, 2011. This was episode 746. Brian Davis from AskBrian.com on the agents and their food. And in this episode, we get really deep into fermented foodstuffs, how fermented foods were traditionally part of human diets for thousands of years, how they are very much, you know, in concert with like a Paleolithic diet. We talk about why our modern diet is wrong for humans. And you guys know me, I'm pretty much a full-on low-carb guy, almost carnivore. Not quite, but almost. I don't hate like all vegetables and things like that. I think there's a real place for this type of food in our lives. And I think that it is definitely true that we gain a lot from a health stance by using foods that are fermented and eating things that I would call ancestrally appropriate and getting those things into our diet. So with that, let's flash back to September 16, 2011, with Brian Davis on the ancients and their food as well. With that, let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate today to have with us a special guest, Mr. Brian Davis, who runs a blog called AskBrian.com, which is really cool and talks about all different types of things from a gardening and nutritional standpoint. Some really cool articles I was reading on there just today, and even a little bit of politics that I think have a bit of libertarian flair to them based on the article I looked at today. He's here to talk to us today, though, about a secret of the ancients, though, folks, lacto-fermented foods. And Brian is he's a pretty cool guy, man. He's really passionate about foods and nutrition. He says about himself, "I ferment foods. I fix things. Broken guts, homes, minds, and machines." His site is a collection of things that he's come across. He's a seeker, a recent paleo primal LCHF diet enthusiast tinkerer. We're going to have to talk about that so that I fully understand it. He's staring down the corporate control of minds. He's here to help you fix your gut, and that'll help you fix your mind. He says that's a scientific fact, Jack, and I don't think he's talking to me. I think he's talking to everyone. Brian, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. You wanted to call today's show The Ancients, right, and talk about this it's almost a lost technology. It's really not, but it's very few people especially do it themselves, other than a can of sauerkraut off a grocery shelf. And I'm sure you're going to tell us why that's not quite what we're looking for. People have really gotten out of the concept of lacto-fermentation. Can you talk a little bit about some of the benefits there and why you have such a passion for it?
Oh, yeah, sure. We need to spread this message. You know, people are taking this knowledge to their graves because of our, you know, the standard American diet, the processed foods, the quick, the convenient. And we need to rediscover this lacto-fermented foods. We could start with the health benefits, you know. Improving your gut, it would be the number one. Your first response, the first thing you're gonna get from this is an improved gut quality, and we can kind of discuss that in detail. And then the second important thing about lacto-fermented foods is food preservation.
I think those are both big topics here with the audience. I mean, can you just kind of maybe start out with why it's so important in the first place that we go into this?
Yeah, sure. For the health perspective, so we're going to take, let's see how this process works. It's a transformation. So we're going to take your harvest, your bounty that you've grown. So let's just say something basic like cabbage, right? And we're going to transform that into something that's extremely healthy beyond the nutrients that are just there in the plant itself. We're going to transform it. We're going to make it healthier for you. We're going to use the natural occurring bacterias and yeast that are on the plant itself. That's that white film you see on a dark green cabbage. You know, that white film. You'll see it also on dark like plums and grapes, that white film.
It almost looks like powder.
It does. You'll often hear it referred to as bloom, the bloom. It looks like a powder. It looks like you want to wash it off. For years, I always wanted to wash that off. I thought it was some chemical spray. I thought it was pesticides or something. Turns out that's lactic acid or lactobacilli bacteria. They're present on the plant to help the plant, to protect it from invaders, from predators. So what we'll do is we're gonna activate that lactobacilli with different techniques. Say, for instance, with cabbage, we're going to add a little salt, a little pressure, a little thyme. It's going to release a lot of its liquid. It's going to be submerged, and then we're going to create lactofermentation. So we're going to activate that lactobacillus. So that bacteria is going to start eating away at the cabbage, and that's going to produce lactic acid and carbon dioxide. The lactic acid is extremely important for your health, for your gut health, and then for preservation. So you kill two birds with one stone. You're going to improve your health, and then that's a stable product. You can keep sauerkraut in a crock in a cool temperature, say if you had a cellar or a basement, for, you know, as short as a week. You could go 3 months, 18 months, even for years. You know, you hear aged for a decade.
Awesome, awesome. And, I mean, you maybe just tell people a little bit, I mean, exactly when we say fermented food, you've kind of covered this already, but exactly what is that? And I mean more than just, like, how does it work? But people know sauerkraut, but it's much right. bigger than that, even with just vegetables, isn't it? There's a lot of other things we can do.
Sure, yeah. So you'll hear the terms pickled and then fermented or lacto-fermented. Pickled really causes some confusion. People like to make pickles or eat pickles. But usually what they're referring to is a vinegar solution or a pasteurized vinegared canning process where you kill every living organism in that jar and then preserve it in vinegar to keep bacteria from growing. What we're doing with lactofermentation is actually encouraging bacterial growth. These are what's commonly referred to now as probiotics. These are the healthy bacteria. And this is the this is why I was referring to the ancients. The ancients, these are our ancestors, and we can look back as far as we need in certain cultures. They didn't know about pasteurization, boiling, preserving in vinegars. They used certain oils, honey, and a lot of these things, all these techniques utilize bacteria for preservation and lactic acid.
What about the person that's kind of hearing this and getting a little bit nervous with it? And mm-hmm. bacteria is a bad thing. Fungus is a bad thing. And
let's jump right on it. Let's attack bacteria real quick. We need to get right on this and understand what is going on. We are 90% bacteria, 90 to 90%. We're about 1 to 10% human. You can look up if any of your listeners know about TED Talks, the greatest minds in the world get down, you know, and talk on. And it's available for free on video. There's a woman, I'll have to double check. I could add you the show notes. Her name is Bonnie Basler. She did a talk on bacteria. This is what she studies. We are bacteria. It is everything about us. There's 2 to 3 pounds of bacteria in our gut right now. Hopefully, if you're sick or ill, maybe less, and you may have a bad balance of bacteria. So your entire digestive tract is containing, like I said, about 2 or 3 pounds of bacteria, and we need to get that balanced in our favor. We need to shift the balance over. So there's your bacteria. And then also, like for when I mentioned gut health, you have a lot of people, about, they say, 50% of people right now are suffering acid reflux or heartburn or GERD or one of these terms. I'm sure you're familiar with it. You've seen the commercials, they're relentless. Prevacid, Nexium.
The purple pill.
The purple pill. Yes, you have to have this. They show the bloat. They show the burn climbing up the throat and then the pushing it back down with the medicine, right? So this is another one of my strategies for life. Get off of pharma. Get that out of your life. I suffered with GERD, stomach problems, every known stomach ailment I had, and suffered miserably for years until I discovered lacto-fermented foods.
You know, it makes me think of, Brian, like looking at your body and cultivating things in your body the way we talk about cultivating things naturally in a garden. You mentioned that, you know, your body is like 90-some-odd% bacteria, and obviously if it's that all the time, then that's good bacteria for us. And it makes me think of insect pests. So we have a garden, and 99% of the insects out there are not pests, and 1% are. And then we go and we nuclear bomb it with chemicals and we kill everything. And then, of course, the pests, when they come back, there's no predators. And they do head spins on top of our cabbage and they eat it all.
They dominate quick.
So our body can be the same way as what you're saying.
Yeah,
we go and
have that
wipe out all the good. And then the bad stuff that's in there just has nothing to compete with it.
You're absolutely right. And the other thing is, when you have a pest in your garden, it is oftentimes it is a clue that there's an imbalance in place. Sometimes they'll identify a sick plant for you. A lot of people don't realize this. Watch these bad pests. Oftentimes you'll see the damage that the pest caused, but it may be an underlying problem of a nutrient deficiency in soil. So something about the plant isn't healthy, and that's why it's being consumed by this pest. Same thing with your body. If you're having a known issue with your stomach, you have an imbalance in your gut. And I'd like to cover heartburn real quick, since approximately half of people, adults, have this now. Everyone thinks it's because you have high stomach acid, and it's untrue. That's good for pharma and the sellers of medicine. You don't typically, almost always, you do not have too much stomach acid. What you have is low stomach acid. Causes a bacterial overgrowth, and you have poorly digested carbohydrates in your stomach. When those two things combine, you get intra-abdominal pressure. Your stomach bloats. It puts pressure on a valve there, and the little bit of stomach acid you have climbs into your throat, into your esophagus, and that burns. And we can fix that like snap with lacto-fermented foods because of the lactic acid present in the foods. And we can fix, if any of your listeners have acid reflux or heartburn, we can fix that without medicine, with cabbage from your garden.
All right, well, exactly how would we do that? I mean, let's go ahead and do a little bit of like a hands-on tutorial here. If I wanted to go ahead and make some lacto-fermented cabbage, or we also call sauerkraut, how would I do that?
Yeah, I'll say, look, this time of year right now, there's got to be cabbages around, right? They're everywhere. If you have them in your garden for a neighbor, wherever, you're going to get your natural, local cabbage, hopefully in the ideal world, pesticide-free and all that. And then also, if you have any roots around or any other interesting vegetation, you can use that as well. Say, throw in some carrots. Think like coleslaw, like that kind of thing. That's kind of like the ingredients, onions, things like that. Gather up a few of those interesting things and chop up some cabbage. Any way you like. You can make it big wedges, little thin ribbons, whatever. However, it doesn't matter. You got to just practice and experience and experiment. But if, say, my grandfather's technique, 1 nickel width That's how the cabbage should be sliced. And then what you're going to do is maybe place that in a big bowl and salt it. And salt it to your liking. You know, if you want to get technical and you want to measure it, you want to weigh it, you can go 2% by weight of salt. That's a good thumbnail for sauerkraut, about 2% salt. But I like to just say, just salt it to your comfort, to what you think would be an adequate amount of salt for that amount of cabbage. And then let it sit, give it some time while you chop more cabbage. Throw in some chopped carrots, onions, things that you like. Mix that all together. We're going to put that in some type of vessel. So you'll have a crock, a mason jar, even a glass cookie jar, anything but metal. You wouldn't want to use any aluminum or anything like that. So I love the fact that you can just use found objects as the vessel that you're going to do this in. And we'll, for starters, we're going to do a quick 1 week ferment on the countertop just so you can see how the process works. We're going to get this cabbage and vegetation pushed into a, let's say, mason jar. We're going to push that down. The liquid in that cabbage is going to release, and you should be able to cover. It'll be enough when you apply pressure that you'll have that cabbage submerge in its own liquid. If you can't get that much liquid out, you'll add a little bit of saltwater brine. Mix that about 2% salt to cover. A little trick you can do to keep this submerged is take a zip-top bag, put it down in the jar, and fill that with water and close it off. That'll just keep it submerged below the liquid. That's really important. And then we'll just cover that with a cloth and a rubber band. Or a lid, if you'd like. You can put a lid on it, but it's going to create a lot of pressure because it's going to create carbon dioxide. So if you put a lid on, keep it loose just to keep the flies and bugs out. And then the magic will happen right on your kitchen counter within 3 days. Then you can try a little bit, see what you think. It's probably going to get better at around day 5, and it's probably going to be great after 7 days. Ideally, sauerkraut, you'd want to go 3 weeks. So what you'd do is room temperature for 2 days and then cool storage for 3 weeks. And it's as simple as that.
And are there other things we can do other than cabbage? I mean, I've looked at doing maybe like, you mentioned pickles, and we can do like lacto-fermented pickles, right?
Real pickles, that's right. The traditional pickle, a lacto-fermented pickle, what you know you might refer to as a deli pickle, like a New York-style pickle. And that's just going to be in about a 5% brine solution, so a lot stronger salt content makes it a good sour pickle. That's what's called a half sour. Is it about 5% brine? And then you're just going to be collecting things from the garden, things that are nearly roadside free. Dill, you know. You can have the dry dill. If you have some in your cabinet, you take your wild dill, your garden dill. You're going to take the whole plant, push it down in that jar. Get your garlic and your pickles. And do that kind of same process where it's submerged. And then it's just time. There is free information available everywhere. You can check out my site. I'll provide you some great books and websites and tips for people that can get just all the basic recipes for themselves.
Are there certain things we should not do this with? And are certain vegetables that are not suitable for this? Or maybe certain vegetables that we can do it, but they need to be combined with something else like
cabbage? That's a good point. Beets. Beets are one of the most wonderful, probably one of the healing plants of all. But to do those on their own is a little tricky, and they create us. They're slimy, kind of. I think it's kind of cool. It's like movie blood. But if you'll combine it with a little bit of cabbage and maybe some onions, the appearance is a lot better. But yeah, that's one of the tricky ones is beets. It takes a little experimentation.
So, I mean, are you familiar with chow chow? I call myself a chow chow connoisseur. My grandmother was big on chow chow, and our chow chow was basically whatever was left at the end of the season that didn't go into something else. And there was always some cabbage in there, and green tomatoes, and carrot, and things like that, and maybe a little couple pieces of cauliflower, and all that stuff together. I mean, I could do that with this technique instead.
Perfect. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh. A little bit of salt, a little water, and a little thyme. Now, one thing to help get things going. Now, when you're talking about your garden vegetables, they are going to have this lactobacillus present on them because they're grown naturally and close to the soil and in real soil. That's where all this beneficial bacteria comes from. But when you're talking about these supermarket hybridized plants that are grown God knows where and in God knows what, you're going to want to get a starter culture, whether that be just some whey removed from some yogurt, or you can get vegetable cultures. You can use a living live sauerkraut juice. That'll have a little bit of a beneficial boost to get the bacteria going for you.
Kind of the way we pitch yeast when we make beer.
Exactly. That's the exact same thing. Yep.
So, I mean, this all sounds good. It makes me hungry. It makes me come back. But I also want to talk about the benefits of it. What are some of the benefits you found during your process of discovery here as you've been doing this and incorporating it into your life? Have you seen like a really meaningful impact? And what kind of speed, you know, what kind of speed has that come on with? Has it been a slow process, a fast process, or what?
Fast process, and the sicker you are, the better you're going to get real quick, especially with the gut. That'll happen right away, and you can wean off of any medications you're on for your gut in no time. Go ask your doctor when you're going to get off your Prevacid or your Tagamet. He's not going to have an answer for you. So that's a zero. You're going to be on that medicine forever.
Well, he may have an answer, and that's probably what it is. Well, forever.
Yeah, that's the answer. There's no weaning off of those medications because they're designed to keep your stomach ill. I would have a warning for anyone of your listeners that are on a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor. That's let's make sure I get the medicines right. I think you're talking Nexium and some of those, but you'll be able to know if you were on a PPI. Ask your doctor, why am I on this PPI? Is this the proper prescription for me? Know this, that is dangerous medicine. You should not be on it, and you can wean yourself off. Don't quit them, though. Don't quit them cold turkey, but we can get you off those medications. They're damaging your stomach, and that's going to damage your health. And another thing I'd like to talk about is what's called the gut-brain axis. So your gut and your brain are connected through this thing called the gut-brain axis. You have neurons in your gut. They actually call it the second brain. You have as many neurons in your gut as many as anywhere else in your body, even more than in your spinal column. And we're just now uncovering this and what it means. So that'll be one of the second things you could notice. As you heal your gut, you will actually fix your mind, and you'll have better clarity of thought. If you have some cloudiness, it kind of lifts. I know it sounds a little mystic and a little mysterious, but there's scientific studies to back this up.
So. It doesn't sound mystic to me. It sounds scientific. If you have a gut that's leaking toxin into your body and you think that that's not going to have an effect on your mental clarity and your mental status, I find that preposterous. We can look at something that, you know, we even say imbibe of recreationally, like alcohol. I like to have a beer or two, but if you drink a lot of beer, to say that it doesn't have a effect on your mind is insane, because of course it does. Well, it's because alcohol itself is, on some levels, we could call it a toxin. I also think it's quite useful in some other ways. But if we have the body producing its own toxins and poisoning itself from the gut outward, and think that that's not going to affect our brains, it seems insane to me that any doctor would try to tell you otherwise.
Very true. And you mentioned something. You mentioned the word leaky gut, and that is an actual clinical problem. Leaky gut, irritable bowel syndrome, leaky gut. This is rampant, and very few people even know that this could be the potential of what's harming them. So when I said earlier, you know, you have this bad bacteria in your stomach, you have poorly digested carbohydrates, those get into your gut and start digesting inside your gut where they were supposed to have been taken care of in the stomach. They actually ferment in your stomach. That can produce hydrogen gas, highly explosive hydrogen gas. Hydrogen is also a molecule so small that's going to be able to pass right through your gut lining. And then also, bad bacteria love hydrogen. They flourish in it. So you'll have bad bacterial overgrowth inside your intestines. So this is just a... It's a cyclical, sick spiral effect, starting, you know, as simply as your stomach and leading eventually to leaky gut, irritable bowel syndrome. And I want people to, if they have any of these issues, we can fix it, and let's fix those that don't have it before they end up with it.
You know, it also makes me think, I don't want to give people an excuse to go out and try to, like, plaster themselves or anything, but I recently got back into homebrewing, and I've always noticed that when I'm drinking a couple homebrews a day versus a couple pasteurized beers a day, that my body seems to function better because there's mm-hmm. living yeast in there as well.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I have my own things with wheats that maybe we can discuss a little bit about what I believe people should eat. Right now, I'm anti any any grains, but in a ferment, things change. Like I said, things are transformed. There are beneficial ways to consume grains, and those are prepared traditionally along ancient cultural techniques. Cultures survive because they worked, because their food worked, and you can't separate this out. So a fermented beer, maybe that is actually beneficial to some degree. But like you said, the mass-produced beer, can it. Shit can it. Get it out of your life. Be responsible and get it out of your life.
Yeah.
Find a local brewer. If you want to drink some beer, find a local guy. There's someone. And if not, learn yourself.
Yeah, it's not a hard thing to do. We've done whole shows on it. You mentioned there are some safer ways to use grains. Well, given this is a preparedness community you're speaking to, a lot of us do store specifically wheat. Because it stores for so long, because it lasts for so long, because it's such a great store of nutrition for hard times. So what are maybe some ways that traditional societies used wheat that we maybe wouldn't recognize today that would be better for people than white bread?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't hear the majority of your question. It was silent. But I think we're talking grains here. Traditionally prepared by sprouting or fermenting grains. So grains were sprouted. And in the beer world, that's a malt.
Correct.
You sprout a grain. So, and then this is also used in, well, let's take the Bible, for instance. Ezekiel, you know what people term Ezekiel bread. That is made from sprouted grains. They'll take 7 different grains and actually sprout them and make the bread with that. The anti-nutrients in the grains are transformed and or removed.
You know, as a brewer, let me speak on that a second, because it makes sense to me. What you were talking about is when we eat certain foods and they're going into our gut and the fermentation process is going on in our gut, especially if you have a starch, then you have a 2-stage fermentation process because the starch has to undergo a conversion to sugar. When you sprout, when you initially first sprout, you begin the starch-sugar conversion, but if you let the sprout go for a while, it actually consumes the majority of the sugar, and then you're left with the base nutritional elements of the grain itself in this new sprout. And so you're not putting excess sugar or starch into your system if you're fermenting the grain before you consume it. I'm sorry, not fermenting, but if you are sprouting the grain before you consume it, then I'd love to hear some ways to ferment grain, because that's going to... Yeah, I want to know perfect. What that does, because you're going to get alcohol. I'm not saying it's bad, but that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, a perfect example there. It's a very similar process to the natural bacteria present in the cabbage, like I mentioned. It consumes the carbohydrates, the starches in that cabbage, and like I said, produces the lactic acid, carbon dioxide. Now, with yeast and sugars, you're in a different world. You're like you said, with the production of sugar, those yeasts produce alcohol in the ferment process. So you will not be producing alcohol consuming the vegetation with bacteria. So the process gets a little confusing, especially if you start talking about other ferments. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard of kombucha, but that's a wildly popular health drink right now. And that's one that I'd recommend everyone giving a try to make at home because it's so easy. And that's a fermented tea. And there is a potential for a little alcohol in that ferment as well because it uses yeasts and bacteria.
But I guess as long as it's not an excessive amount, it's not really a big deal.
You're talking half of 1%.
No, it's meaningless. You're going to get more than that walking by a bar and breathing
fumes. Yep, it's a wash. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the body can handle a certain amount of alcohol as though it were any other thing that goes into the body that needs to be handled.
Yeah, it's comparable to aged orange juice, actually.
Okay.
You'd have orange juice that's a little bit tangy. There's about that much alcohol in that.
Do you have any recipes or ways to use grain?
Well, here's a good one. There's a beverage called Rejuvelac. So right now I'm focused on not eating the grains, but you can look at, like I said, Ezekiel-type bread and kind of read about that and get your background there. But I know of a beverage called Rejuvelac. It takes some rye berries. These are the whole rye, and these are sproutable. And you're going to submerge these in water, do some water changes, you know, where you soak them, drain them, soak them, drain them, and then let them sprout. And when they sprout, you're going to fill this with water, and you're going to create a beverage called Rejuvelac. And all it is the water that the sprouted grains are in. They're going to sit in that for 12 to 24 hours. It is a powerful elixir. I don't know if you're, many people may be familiar with Candida or Candida overgrowth. A lot of women have experience with this. This is a yeast overgrowth in your body, and this Rejuvelac will knock it right out. It's a very simple recipe. I can give you a link so that people can follow along with the instructions. See, that's the thing with ferments. It's not really recipes. It's technique and instructions, not so much a recipe.
That makes sense. And that's actually always say with cooking anyway, that you're better off with technique because then you can work with whatever you happen to have.
Right.
Moving on, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, it seems like you're really informed on nutrition, some general nutrition things that people can do to be in better health. I mean, you said not to eat grains. Did I hear you say not to eat legumes as well?
Sure. So my approach would be, this is what I said on my website, you know, I'm a paleo primal enthusiast. So there's this diet, let's call it a diet, paleo diet. This is a removal of grains, legumes, and dairy from your diet. This is based on evolution, if you believe in evolution. You could say we've been human for 2.5 to 3 million years. And for all but the last 10,000 years of that, we ate a certain way. And then with the advent of agriculture, we ended up eating a completely different way. And that's the grains and legumes.
And so I guess you're fine with meat then.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, we're going to get along just fine then.
We got to nail. You have to understand. Let's talk meat. Let's talk grass-fed beef. You know, bison from ranges that are raised naturally. These are superfoods. This is what humankind was meant to eat. These ruminants that chew the grasses, they're converting solar energy into powerful food for you. I strongly believe in eating meat. I was a vegetarian for 2 years. And I just, let's say the beginning of this year, went paleo and reintroduced meat into my diet and into my family's diet. And the health transformations have been remarkable. And I'm talking about going from vegetarian, which is supposedly healthy. I did manage to lose 40 pounds vegetarian, but I had a flabby gut. I looked like the doughboy. If you took my shirt off, you know, you'd stick your finger 3 inches into my gut, even though I weighed less. And going paleo causes you to get lean, strong, and fit and more alert. It's absolutely magic. My wife has lost 65 pounds from her pregnancy weight, you know, from after she gave birth, to a weight at, well, I'm going to ruin the surprise here, nearly 40 years of age. Sorry, honey.
Good luck with that, Brian.
Yeah, we'll see how that flies. But anyways, she's at less than her high school weight.
Unbelievable.
She does not do yoga. She does no cardio. She raises kids and works. She doesn't exercise for the sake of exercising, but she does work out because we've got three little kids. So,
Yeah, and I'm going to say something about the losing weight thing. It's not good to be fat. I've lost quite a bit of weight in the last year myself. I've actually lost about 40 pounds, almost 45 pounds at this point. And I think I've done it right, and there's been plenty of meat involved with it. Somebody pointed out to me one time that just because you're losing weight doesn't mean you're healthy. That if you go to a hospital and you look at people laying in bed dying, they're all losing weight.
Sure.
So you can be losing weight.
You can be losing weight and dying. Sure.
If you have cancer, you're going to lose weight. If you're getting chemotherapy for cancer, you're going to lose weight. Neither one of those are, you know, you're not going to hear the cancer diet plan. You get cancer, lose weight. Nobody wants that. So
we're going to feed ourselves and lose weight. Say, I throw that up in quotes, or not. You may maintain the exact same weight, but your body is going to transform. When I went paleo, my weight has not changed since I was vegetarian, but my body looks radically different. I just leaner. Like, people see me, they're like, oh my God, how much more weight are you going to lose? I'm like, I weigh 175. I weighed 175 January 1st. I weigh 175 today. But I look radically different. From my neck, my midsection, completely slimmer.
I would say that's because it's probably your weight you should be at. And had you weighed 225 pounds when you went paleo, you probably would have lost the 50 right down to 175.
I'd be at this weight, I think, either way.
Yep.
Whichever way would have been that approach. Now, let's talk about people with a big midsection.
Okay.
This is huge. Check out this new book called Wheat Belly by Dr. William Davis, called Wheat Belly. It explains it all. And with the most simple thing, removing wheat from your diet will radically transform your health. It's especially curious for anyone who's interested in agriculture. Let's uncover the real truth about wheat and what happened. Wheat is not what you think it is. If you think you're eating wheat that your parents ate, or even the wheat that you ate when you were a kid, you're not. It changed in the 70s. Read the story. It's mind-boggling to find out that what we're eating doesn't even resemble the wheat we ate previously. And the harmful effects it has on our health. So you have that big midsection. That's directly related to your lifespan. Having that big midsection really can drastically shorten your life. And then also, let's get back into the survivalist idea, right? You need, I've been reading your tenets. They really speak to me. They're beautiful, and I want to look at those. And I think, well, you know what? One thing in these tenets that you need is physical fitness. If there's a situation and you need to move and you need to get going, I know hunkering down and having some weapons is awesome, but you may need to run from a fire. You may be able to need to rescue someone, yourself or a child. You need some physical fitness. If you've got this big fat belly and you can't run, and you've got edema, red swollen legs, or you weigh 350 pounds and you fall down, you may be left behind because there aren't four guys that can carry you on a stretcher. Why not get lean? And, you know, that's why I go a little crazy when I think I get sad for people that have poor physical health when it's 90% just the nutrition that you eat. Removing wheat is the very first step towards fixing that. Well, I should say, fermenting foods first and removing wheat. And then if you want to carry it out and investigate a little further, read about paleo. The reason I love paleo food, the paleo diet, is it's 100% based on food. There's no bars, there's no protein bars, there's no shakes, there's no product to buy.
Gee, I wonder why it's not marketed heavy.
Here's the problem, why no one's heard of paleo. There's no TV commercial. There's nothing. There is an awesome book called The Paleo Solution, written by Rob Wolf. R-O-B-B, Wolf. That book is a treasure. It's easy to read. It's got a lot of science in it, and you can skip that section if your eyes start glazing over. And just get to the nuts and bolts of it. Get on that diet. He calls it a buy-in. You need to buy in for 30 days. Just go with the program for 30 days, and you're buying food. You're not sending checks to him. He's not mailing you shit bars, Cliff bars, whatever the, you know, hate fake food. Real food for real humans, and get on board. 30 days later, you're pretty much every biomarker that you have, your lipid, your blood, your whatever you want to test, you're going to feel and perform better eating this way.
You know, Brian, on the meat thing, I know a lot of people are trying to get more sustainable now, and I hear things, and even a good friend of mine recently was talking about how, you know, is meat sustainable, and he's a very much a protein eater, and probably like, I'm going to have a cow on my property anyway, even though it may not be sustainable. I think it's far more sustainable than grain or grain-fed meat to do pasture cows, and here's what I mean by that. If I take any kind of an annual grass or grain crop, be it corn or wheat or barley or even something like a grass that's conventionally grown annually for cattle, maybe alfalfa, which is a legume, and I put that into a pasture and I grow it, and I grow it very, very well. I even do it the right way, and I do it healthy, and I don't infect it or anything else. If I pull that up from the ground, I'm going to see a root system that goes down about 12 inches.
Mm-hmm.
If I let native prairie grass grow back, and I've got to pull the ruminants off the land long enough for it to heal after it's been abused. But once it grows back, I would have to literally get a track hoe and carve out to even see the root profile, because I'm going to end up with a root system in those perennial grasses that's 5 to 7 feet deep and in some cases 12 feet of
that's
root
right.
system.
That's
now,
right.
that is, once that's there, as long as I don't overgraze it, as long as I move my ruminants around,
mm-hmm.
that is bulletproof. It can stand up to the worst droughts that you can possibly imagine. If I do a few things with some land sculpting and swaling to irrigate the system, I can even put trees into certain components of it, and I can take and I can run cattle, or I can run any other type of protein source, hogs, anything I want to, chickens, ducks, geese. I can run them on that land forever.
Right.
And the
forever.
Only thing I have to do is harvest and maybe bring in some new genetics once in a while.
Yeah.
To me, that's more sustainable than a soybean field, even if I'm eating soy.
Soy, corn, yeah, it's just despicable. It's monocropping, despicable, despise, I mean, just loathsome. But what you were describing there, you're honoring the natural system. You're honoring the sun and what it does, fuels the grasses. These animals live off the grasses. Ruminants, look, that's what they eat. They eat grass. They don't eat corn. They don't eat seeds. Now, you let these ruminants do their work and follow the natural system. Think of like if your listeners know anything about Joel Salatin and his farming techniques. Like you said, it's a rotation. The ruminants come through. They munch off the top of the grasses. They lay down their patties, their manure. You put the flies. The larvae gets on there. He runs his chickens across that. Chickens eat the larvae. Refertilize. It's honoring this natural cycle. You'll always see in nature, you'll see the bison. As the herd moves, what comes in behind them? Flocks of birds. You can farm mimicking natural systems. When you do that, you're naturally sustainable. You don't have to invent tilapia fish farms in a cement building, trying out insane aquaponics. I get that. I'm glad people are on that. There may be a day when we really need that. So I'm glad that's out there. But I'm just saying, in the fields and in the grasses, you know, in your backyard, there's a natural system. If you honor it, it'll feed us.
Yeah, and what ruined it were roads and barbed wire, because the buffalo herds wandered, and it's amazing, right? There were like 50 million of them just in the heartland, and they never overgrazed anything, and no one told them where to go. They just kind of figured it out for themselves. But in our modern systems, if we want them to be sustainable, we have to move them around because we can't give them the space anymore that they used to have. The invention of barbed wire was as much the end of the buffalo as the 4570 lead slug.
Right, and trains with rich white folk shooting out the window, knocking these poor guys down. Right. Yeah. That's perfect. Just honoring the natural systems, letting these ruminants do their job. And back to people. I love this. There's an author, Jay Stanton. He's got a quote: "Eat like a predator, not like prey." I think that's a great metaphor for your diet and for your overall health. Eat like a predator, not like prey. Don't eat birdseed. Rabbits and birds and these things that you eat, that's what they eat. Don't eat that. Eat the rabbit, right?
You know, you're saying things that I say all the time, and every time I say this stuff, I get people posting links to this thing called the China Study. Are you familiar with that?
You want to blow that away? Let's cover that. China Study is total BS, cherry-picked bad science. There's our science writer. Her name's Denise Minger. She single-handedly completely debunked and wrecked the China Study. Other studies, look at Ansel Keys. The reason we are afraid of fat right now, the reason we're afraid of saturated fat, bad, bogus, cherry-picked, BS, bullshit science. That's the seven countries study, right? They found seven countries with some correlations that seemed to appear as if some countries that ate high saturated fat had higher risk of heart disease. Well, there was 25 countries in the study, right? And all that information is missing.
They just took the other ones out. That sounds like clarity. You know, this creates a variation. Let's just we'll push it out of the graph.
Put that right off, and then look, we've got our result. You know, in a study, you can find whatever you're looking for if you're willing to manipulate the data. Remove what you don't want.
Yep.
Focus on what you do. Write a summary that that favors you. But
I've always said, as a former sales and marketing guy, if you put data into a spreadsheet for me, I don't care what the source of the data is, you tell me the picture you want the graph to display, and by manipulating axis and hiding columns, I can make that graph I can make it show growth, I can make it show decline from the same data sets. I can make the growth look extreme, I can make it look moderate, I can make the decline look extreme or moderate. I can make any segment of the graph look like a problem or a solution because I understand how a spreadsheet works and how macros work and how axes work. And I think that this kind of crap is done all the time in the nutritional industry because if you go into something that you're doing quote unquote research with and you already know the result you want coming out, there's no way your results are pure.
Well, look, your study has to be funded. You're going to get paid. You're getting paid.
American Soy Farmers Association is funding your study.
Someone with some money is paying you to do the study. They want a result that they want. And if they don't get it, there goes your funding. There goes you're done. They're looking for results. They're paying for results. And that's what they're going to get. And who has money? Pharma has money. Like you just said, pharma council. Some people, but like I said, the paleo diet, they don't have a fund, but we can study the natural system, get back on board, rediscover what ancient man ate and thrive.
What are your thoughts on meat for the homestead? The guy that's only got 4 or 5 acres and really can't, maybe he can run one hog or one cow a year, but, rabbits, goat,
yeah.
If it's meat, eat it.
Wild animals are great, but don't get caught up in thinking that you can live off of rabbit. You can't. They're too lean. There is a thing, an actual term called rabbit starvation, if you've heard of that.
I've heard of it. I'm going to bust that myth, though, for you.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tear that myth up. Rabbit starvation, if you live on nothing but rabbit, especially wild rabbit, you're going to get into a point of basically your starvation is a depletion of fat. If you're growing rabbit that's well-fed, it's going to have a little bit more fat on it. If you're eating rabbit 2 or 3 times a week and other things like beef and lamb and venison, it's not even an issue.
Awesome.
And if you had to live on rabbit, if you would eat things like the internal organs, like the kidneys and the liver, you're going to get more fat than you can possibly imagine. So it's all based on how we choose to use the rabbit.
How it's raised and how it's eaten. That's right. You have to honor the way animals were eaten in the past. Organs were saved and nearly worshipped, usually fed to seniors and pregnant women or women. Got the organ meats first to further us, to make sure a woman was healthy enough to carry a child. She got the organ meats. And then also, because they honored their the elders in their community, they were also given the choice organ meats. They went to them first. Then we ate the fatty cuts. They would reserve the lean cuts and wrap them in fat. They would literally take a lean cut. The lean cuts to them were nearly the garbage. They were like the hoof. So for them, they had to wrap it and encase it in fat to make it a viable food. So it's fun to discover the way older ancient civilizations, even just a few generations back, depending on where your people are from, the way they handled, respected the earth, animals and their own community.
You know, it makes me think, I used to read a lot of books on hunting, and some of my favorite things to read as a kid were the books of Robert Rourke. And this is a guy that was hunting in Africa right after World War II, so we're looking at the 50s here, so that's not that long ago. And that was back in the days, though, when a safari party would be, you know, the white hunter, the client, maybe his wife, and a cadre of maybe 30 as a staff of natives that would go and move this little movable tent city throughout the hunting ranges. And there were different jobs, and there were cooks and porters mm-hmm. and everything else. The two most prestigious jobs that you could possibly have was, one was the gun bearer slash tracker that was right there with the client and the Bawana the whole time. And the second and equally prized was to be a skinner. If you were a skinner, when you took care of the animal for the client, the first thing you did when you went to gut it was open it up, and in these lean plains animals, there'd be two long strips of fat right on the inside, pure fat, and the first thing they would do is take those out, and the gun bearer at the prestigious level would get one, and then the skinners would split the other one. And that was like the most important thing in the world is to get the piece of fat out of the impala. And they could care less about the chops that the client was eating that night over the fire, even though they tasted great and they're probably great for you. Sure. They wanted that fat.
Absolutely. That's where it's at. And that's a wonderful story. I like that. I like that little bit of history lesson there.
Well, it's just neat, like you say, you start talking about the stuff that happened, it just makes the mind switch on, and we start to remember all these things. And I think you're right, people are going to their grave with the information, because society's put us to sleep. Society has conditioned us to believe that whole wheat bread is good for us.
Yes, right.
You said, it's not even the wheat that we were eating 25 years ago. It's not whole wheat. 99% of wheat, you see whole wheat bread. That means they threw a little bit of whole wheat powder in there. God knows what other crap's in there. It's probably been sprayed with insecticide.
Yeah, corn, soy, wheat. That's it. It's in everything that's in a box. So
as a survivalist-minded person that wants to store food, like I said, we do store a lot of wheat. And that's something we store a lot of because we need something to stretch if we ever had to go 3 months, 6 months without systems of support. What are some other things we can do? I mean, I make biltong, but you make that with lean meat, jerky, you know.
Right.
Are there other ways that we can create stores of food and meet this paleo requirement?
Yes. For meats, so you have your preservation methods, your dry preservation, your salts, your cured meats. That's a fine, awesome art form. That's going to give you a nice subset, a nice place. Then also the frozen meats. How sustainable that is for obviously freezers are going to require power. In a reasonable failure of society, we may still have electricity and freezers, right? Whether you have a generator.
Absolutely.
Or whatever. So let's save, get your vegetables out of the freezer. They cannot really sustain you. Vegetables are nice, they're cute, they taste good, and they help fill you up a little bit. But believe me, spinach ain't where it's at, okay? It took an animal a hell of a lot of grass to make that muscle, okay? You're getting some massive nutrients in meat. Use your freezer space for meat. Freeze your meat. And let's keep that there. A little bit of produce in there is fine, especially to fill it in and keep the freezer full. So anytime your levels get a little low, keep that freezer full. You can freeze your fresh vegetables that you get out of the garden, local farmer's market, wherever. So that's a great way to keep your meat. And then with the fermentation, like I said, let's say, for example, last November I put up my big sauerkraut for the winter. So that was in November. I'm still eating it. It's September. I'm eating it from last year. And that's I did 55 pounds of sauerkraut.
You know, and folks, I want to tell you, that's not that hard to grow that in a relatively small plot in your own backyard. That's something you can do. And I think that, I mean, I want to make sure people get this out of you today, Brian, or, you know, the whole interview doesn't really drive home what we're trying to say here. If you eat a piece of cabbage, that's one thing, and it's only got so many calories and what have you, and it only has certain nutritional value. When you convert it into a lacto-fermented product, it changes the value that it is to your body immensely.
The bioavailability of nutrients is dramatically increased. So not just from the bacterial perspective, but the nutrients in the food. So fermentation actually removes what are called anti-nutrients. This is only done two ways, fermentation and cooking. There's things like phytic acid and other things. Fermenting foods removes these anti-nutrients. Remember, anti-nutrients are there. Some plants want to be protected. They don't want to be eaten. They want to go to seed and spread, right? That's their nature. They don't necessarily want to be consumed in the plant state before they get to seed, or they would fail. They would disappear. So they have present anti-nutrients. Some things are bitter, you know, so that they're not flavorfully attractive to eat. Well, we can eliminate these anti-nutrients through fermentation. You're going to get a healthier food product. Like I said, it's called bioavailability of the nutrients.
That's absolutely awesome, Brian. Well, I'd like to thank you for being with us here today. I'll give you a chance for any final thoughts you want to deliver before we wrap up.
Yeah, sure. Look at your local community. Now, I'm not expecting everyone to go out and start fermenting foods, but how about if one person in your community that had the time and the space could do it? What if you donated the jars? What if your community got together? What if you have a large grower in your neighborhood? They've got an abundance of produce. Why don't you all get together, ferment the foods, put them in one or two locations, and save that up? Then you all have equal access and you're all responsible for it. Or if one person can take it on themselves, become an entrepreneur. Start teaching the art of fermentation. Do workshops. Become the local supplier. Do it on the black market. Sell to your family, friends. Check into the state. See if you can go legit and sell at farmers markets. So there's an entrepreneurial aspect here by learning ancient and cultural foods. Teach it. I want more people to get out there. I don't want to be the guy. I want every community to have a guy, right? And I'll leave it at that.
I think that's awesome advice, and what a great way to start spreading the preparedness mindset. The minute you're storing food, guess what? You've crossed over to the, not the dark side, but what I consider the light side, the side that's responsible for yourself and for your community. So, Brian, again, I appreciate you being with us today. Folks, again, you can get on Brian's website. It's at Ask Brian, and it's B-R-Y-A-N. Brian spelled that way, AskBrian.com. I'll have links to there in the show notes today, and I will have any links that Brian sends to me on email after we wrap up here. I'll shove them in there for you as well, so for your ease of use. And again, Brian, hey, man, thanks for being with us on the show. Love to have you back in the future to talk about more of this stuff.
Thank you, Jack. It was awesome.
All right, man. And with that, this has been Jack Spirko today, along with Brian Davis, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't.
It's in our food these days, you know, it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I could do. It's the price we pay, I guess, and we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Right.
solution is you.